Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your guest host, Jonathan V. Last, sitting in for Charlie Sykes today on Monday, March 16th, the first day of Virusageddon or whatever. I don't know what we're going to call it.
Coronageddon.
I'm joined today by my colleagues, Jim Swift, Ben Parker, and Tim Miller. Hey, gentlemen, how are you?
Hi, JVL.
Surviving.
I'm lonely.
Is everybody quarantined? How much physical human contact have you guys had outside of your immediate families over the last 72 hours?
I had the Comcast cable guy came over. I stayed a nice 9 feet distance from him. And then the TV tech on my very important midday cable news show. And I think those are the only two other individuals I've contacted since Friday.
Yeah. Ben, what's going on? Didn't you tease me with something had happened to you? You've said you had a story.
It's not much of a story, but someone who I was in close contact with, I think a handshake and a hug or something like that, maybe a little more than a week ago, and now I learn has flu-like symptoms. So until a period of 14 days since that event has passed, I'm down to basically not leaving my apartment and minimal human contact just to be on the safe side. So yeah, it's basically full quarantine for me.
That's great. Well, you know, I was looking back, and just a couple weeks ago, Larry Kudlow was on CNBC assuring America that this stuff was contained and it was basically airtight. And so we didn't have anything to worry about. So we're in a new world. Yesterday,
Larry did that twice, JVL. This is, you know, people can go to the handy dandy timeline that I put on the bulwark.com. And I've enjoyed this because people have sort of been re-upping this quote that you referenced of Larry from March 6th saying everything's contained. But that was actually 17. Oh, wait, no, I'm struggling with math right now. There are only 28 days in February, whatever. It was about 10 days earlier when the stock market was at a bullish 27,900 that he first suggested to buy the dip. That was very bad financial advice from the chief economic advisor to the president of the United States.
I can't believe it. Larry Kudlow giving financial advice to people that didn't work out. You know, this is the thing that drives me most nuts about all of this is that there are a bunch of people who have behaved terribly irresponsibly, one of whom is Larry Kudlow. You could see lots and lots of others on the Twitters, and Jim and Tim both collected a bunch of them. There won't be any price to be paid for that, I think, when this is all over. Nobody will ever go back and say, hey, you know what? Sheriff David Clark was telling people to go out in the streets and go to dinner and, you know, screw the libs and own the libs by congregating in big crowds. And drives me crazy. So, boys, what do we think of the big Fed stuff, big Fed news from last night?
Just really quick before the Fed news, it is worth, while we're, you know, if nobody's going to hold anyone accountable, we might as well do it here on the Bulwark Podcast. And yeah, this just proves your exact point, JVL. But you know, for maybe the younger listeners, Kudlow did this same exact thing in the 2008 economic collapse when Bush was president. I mean, he was just a CNBC talking head at that point. But you know, he was again telling everybody to calm, telling everybody that the stock market was going to hit 40,000. So you know, this is, and then 10 years later, he gets named the chief economic advisor to the president of the United States. So if that doesn't underscore your point about how nobody is going to be held responsible or have any repercussions for this, I mean, that Kudlow is like example 1, 2, and 3. And you know, that's why you know, I'm going to yoga a lot more out here and just trying to, you know, kind of breathe deeply and understand that nobody will be ever held accountable for their actions.
Tim, did you remember the book Dow 35,000?
I was going on it from memory. I thought it was 40. I do remember the book. It was 35,000.
Dow 35,000, and I believe it's Jim Glassman and Kevin Hassett who wrote this. And one of the most spectacularly wrong books ever by two supposedly serious economists. And their penalty for having written one of the wrongest books written in the last like 50 years was to go on to populate the highest reaches of Republican presidential administrations.
Yeah, chairman amazing, of the Council of Economic Advisors. Pretty good job for Kevin Hassett.
Unbelievable. So, Jim, what do you make of the Fed's actions last night, which clearly seem to have calmed the stock market and convinced everybody on Wall Street that everything is good?
I think we are experiencing, and of course, the stock market was halted this morning, as you were clearly joking. I think what we are experiencing is a Toyota-thon level event. And if you don't know the term Toyota-thon, it's that we're saved by zero. And that is what the Fed is doing by cutting rates and pumping in hundreds of billions of dollars, probably might even get close to a trillion, to bring liquidity into the markets. And I think that's a panic move. And you know, you saw yesterday when President Trump came out, I mean, the Fed is supposed to be independent from politics. But President Trump, unlike any president before him, loves bullying the Fed. I don't know, maybe we'll find out in 10 years whether or not, you know, when Jerome Powell or someone writes their tell-all book, whether or not the Fed does respond when the president, you know, was bullying them. But it's not a good sign. And I saw on the Twitters, which we should always note is not indicative of real life, someone asked, can the stock market go to zero? And that's like a trending Google question. So, which I would call a true Toyota-thon. We're already there with interest rates.
And it's worth pointing out, I think, here that and Desmond Lachman has made this point at least once in on the Bulwark, that it doesn't help that the Fed didn't have that much room to work with already. The government is already in huge debt, so there's not as much room as they would otherwise have for monetary stimulus. And the Fed already had very low interest rates. And, you know, unless you're going to do what the ECB and I think the Bank of Japan have done and go to negative interest rates, which I don't think they want to do for obvious reasons, there's not that much room they could move. So what was it, 10 days ago or something, they cut rates by a half a point or a half a percent in one fell swoop, and now they're moving down to near zero. But that's not that far from where we started. They didn't have that much room to work with.
How does a negative interest rate work? Do any of you guys know? Is it like I borrow $100, but I only have to pay you back 90?
You're getting paid to borrow money, right? I mean, it's a way to kind of it's almost like modern monetary theory, and it's like bonkers Keynesianness. I mean, it really is like the hair of the dog in terms of trying to get people to commit economic activity.
Yeah, I'm trying a new thing where I don't pop off on things that I know nothing about. And monetary policy, I think, is, you know, number maybe two or three on the list of things I know the least about. But I was reading, you know, our former Weekly Standard alum Greg Easterbrook, who knows a little bit about economic studies, and he, you know, made this point that just as an observer of trends seems right, which is if you look at countries like Japan, if you look at other countries that have gone through this, when interest rates lower to this amount amidst a downfall, all that shows to the markets is that they're panicking, right? The signal that was sent, this is the point Easterbrook was making, is a signal that was sent to the markets with the Fed's moves was that you know, they don't know what else to do, so they're bringing, you know, they're going to their move of last resort. And I think that combined with you know, Trump's air of panic is, you know, it really just isn't doing anything to actually, you know, create any long-term or medium-term stimulus.
You know, and doing it in the dead of night on Sunday night before the markets open is, again, not something that telegraphs a whole lot of confidence. That feels like panic. Did you guys read, we had a piece up over the weekend by Stephen Hamilton and Stan Voiger, who are economists, one from George Washington University, one from AEI. And they talked about how this is a weird recession and that most recessions, the problem is that you've got to stimulate economic activity because people don't want to spend money. But what we're going to go through here is not at all like that. It's like an artificial recession because people can't spend money. And their argument is that what a bailout or a stimulus package here should do is really just try to put a Band-Aid over this short-term problem. So you basically got to keep people, you know, I think what they're essentially saying is you want to hand out checks both to people who can't work so that they don't, you know, they can make their rent for the next 2 months, and to businesses that are in danger of going belly up so that they can paper things over and make it through for the next 2 months. And then once we all come out the other side, so long as all the economic actors and infrastructure are still in place, there's no theoretical reason we can't just keep moving and pick back up again. You know, the machine restarts itself. And I thought that seemed pretty interesting because what it means is that the stock market here is really kind of irrelevant to what's actually going on with the broader economy.
You know who this benefits is Bernie Sanders. Andrew Yang, if he were still running, giving people money who can't work, is perfectly in line with what Andrew Yang was saying the economy should do. And, you know, President Trump has taken the action. The federal government is the largest holder of student loans, right? He waived interest. He's not waiving repayment. But I was just talking with some friends and family just last night, and they're like, "Well, maybe they'll just start waiving mortgage payments." And I think it'll be an interesting, depending on the length and the severity of the crisis and how long this goes on. The Fed is pretty much, as Ben noted, out of tricks. But what will President Trump offer? And I think it'll be interesting because the RNC has always been positioning. This 2020 election, and the debate was last night, we can talk about that in a little bit, is, you know, Trump versus socialism. I suspect you're going to see a lot of what the experts would call socialism being proposed by the Trump administration.
The one thing, if he wasn't so incompetent, that Trump has going for him in this is that he isn't really beholden to, you know, free market, you know, economic principles, or he isn't beholden to, you know, having to be concerned about pushback from the right, about just doing a financial handout. So I think if you go back to the article you referenced, Jonathan, what Stan put out, and I do just want to say as a quick aside, even though he's a boring economist, Stan Buger is a very underrated Twitter feed, which I highly recommend. Their recommendation of just handing out money is seeming to gain currency, you know, on the right, from people who have freedom to not be, you know, shackled by concerns about what Jim's saying about being called a socialist. Cotton was on Fox and Friends this morning, and basically outflanked Pelosi. Cotton's feedback when asked about the bill that the House passed while the Senate was on a 3-day vacation this weekend was that it didn't go far enough. And that Cotton thinks that there should be more financial handouts. So I think that shows you kind of where, you know, this debate, you know, has moved and how quickly it's moved that direction.
Well, the big problem with this is figuring out who needs the handouts, right? I mean, it's the devil is always in the details with these things, because this is the first time in, I don't know, 20 years where being in the media is not a terrible place economically, because we can all do our jobs from home. But if you're in a service industry, or you work in hospitality or events or anything like that, then all of a sudden there are real problems. And so the tough part is, at scale of, you know, 330 million people, how do you identify in a smart way who actually needs to get a bailout and who doesn't? The Australians have done this by tackling sort of apprentice-like jobs, I think. They have a term of art for how they've done this. But this is, I would say, again, is in theory, we all know basically what should be done. The problem is, in practice, how do you target the money to the people who actually need it?
Well, especially when different states are going to react in different ways. Ohio, where I grew up, is, you know, kind of leading the way in terms of, taking extreme lengths compared to other states to use precautions to flatten the curve, as they're saying. If Ohio is doing that, and, you know, another state, you know, I won't name states because I don't know how every state is responding, but just pick another state is, you know, kind of almost doing the opposite of that. It's hard to get that money in the hands of the people who need it most. And that would also, you know, be precipitated on having the federal government step in to kind of standardize and you know, kind of come up with a nationwide set of rules and guidelines. And I don't think I don't see that coming.
And they don't have time for it, or I don't think the capability to do it. You know, at this point, if that's the concern, why not just write a check to everybody? You know, which seems to be the easiest solution if that's the path that they're going to go.
Yeah. Speaking of Andrew Yang.
And George W. Bush, you know, by the way, for the President Bush was not beholden to the you know, Cato point of view on this. He sent everybody a check in I guess 07, probably fall of 07.
I remember that. I bought a spring gun
of 08. I forget. You bought a gun?
I was single and unmarried, and it was just like, hey, I got a check for $600, so I went out and bought a gun.
I think we're gonna have to put you on the couch and spend a little bit more time with that on a different podcast about why you chose to go buy a gun as a single man.
It was a scary time, Tim. People were prepping.
So do any of you guys have prepper stories or things to point out? Did you all see the piece in the New York Times over the weekend about the brothers from Tennessee who several weeks ago rented a giant U-Haul truck and just drove around buying hand sanitizer from every little store they could find, just clearing out the shelves so they could then resell them on Amazon?
Oh, my wife's going to get so pissed at me because I think that those guys deserve respect.
I agree.
You people
totally agree. There, that was the entrepreneurial spirit. You know, it was early in the crisis. You know, I think that at this point, you know, probably the right thing to do is to, you know, get the U-Haul back out and bring the sanitizer to various churches and nursing homes. But well, you know, at the time, these were guys that saw an opportunity.
Hey, price rations. I when it comes to economics, the price gouging things. Like, I get it. This is a pandemic, but at the end of the day, the best way to ration is via price.
No, but the problem is they're rationing via supply. I mean, there is a difference between going out and producing a bunch of things and prospectively going out and soaking up all the supplies so that you can practice arbitrage and do price gouging, right? I mean, these are very different. The problem isn't that you could ration it. If all the dollar stores started like ticking up the price of Purell, that is how you would ration it. Two guys running around and getting a monopoly on the supply of stuff so they can sell it for $70 a pop on Amazon is not really.
JBL, I'm with you. I'm with you on the facts, but I do still have a tinge of remaining respect for the entrepreneurial spirit. You know, something I know that you've lost is an Elizabeth Warren, economic.
It's not a monopoly though. There are substitute goods. It's called soap.
There are also other places to buy hand sanitizer, even if you happen to live in this part of Tennessee, right? I mean, Jeff Bezos,
David French, hardest hit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Amazon will still sell you hand sanitizer, and they are doing sort of the same thing you described, JVL, which is like if you go to the dollar store, you know, all of the different people selling Amazon on hand sanitizer on Amazon are taking up the price considerably. But it's not like, you know, these guys are preventing their local hospital from buying hand sanitizer.
Yeah, they are, because there isn't any hand sanitizer left. This is the problem. I mean, it is not the case where there is an infinite supply. Hey, listen, I'm not going to get bogged down in the economics here. I would like to highlight the characterological part of it, which is that these guys, shortly after spending all this money to acquire this vast stock to then sell them for $70 a bottle, suddenly had Amazon and eBay crack back against them and say, we're not going to let you do this because you're price gouging, which is illegal in many states and which we do not endorse on our platform. And so these guys then run to the New York Times to cry poor and talk about how they're the real victims here because they're sitting on 20,000 cases of Purell and they have no way to sell it. It's the most
the Times was probably the wrong place to go with that, but it is hard for me to. I mean, poor Amazon is really cracking down on these guys. You know, I'm a little bit suspect that the motives were pure on behalf of the Seattle BMF.
So someone who's close to me works for a industrial company that makes something that consumers think is a disinfectant, but it is not. And their sales are through the roof.
That's very
That's despicable.
We're going to have to talk a little bit more about this offline.
Silver Saul.
But they're not misrepresenting it, right?
It's just people are stupid.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. That sounds all right. Probably a lotion of some sort. So, all right, let's turn away from pandemic stuff. Can we talk briefly about the debate last night between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden?
You did it. Can we do one last thing on the pandemic? Yeah, sure. I'd like to have you kind of weigh in on this as well. And I'm noodling on doing something longer about this. But I still, the thing that I think that has been the most missing from this discussion, and you know, we can kind of rattle on about, you know, the incompetence of Trump and our TDS, you know, for hours, of course, but there's his inability in the makeup of his character to understand anything related to self-sacrifice makes him uniquely ill-suited to be the person that is leading us at this time where we're demanding quasi-voluntary significant self-sacrifice for the entire country. You know, you know, I think that you kind of pointed out in a newsletter last week about how upset that made you, about how, you know, the message that everything was okay was going out to people who are for very vulnerable. But, you know, the thing that's made me upset is, on top of that, is through casual conversations I've had with people who aren't like Uber on Twitter like me, who you know, aren't Uber watching cable news all the time, is people still don't really understand the full reason for why they're quarantining, and why, if they're a young and healthy person, that they're, you know, not allowed to go to the bars that they want to go to, or go, you know, to yoga class or whatever it is. And we have not, we don't have anyone, there's this kind of vacuum of moral leadership of being able to say, the reason why we are all quarantining is to protect the vulnerable members of society, and everybody's going to have to sacrifice. Everyone is going to have to tighten their belt for 6 weeks so that people who are vulnerable can live. And you know, this is potentially an opportunity to kind of lift the country up and heal some of our wounds. And it just doesn't feel like anybody, the president in particular, is capable of delivering that message.
Well, but we don't do sacrifice anymore. You know, I mean, even after 9/11, George W. Bush was like, hey, everybody, go shopping. Right. You know, I mean, do you remember that? There was hey, you know what? We are in for a generations long struggle against an enemy which hates our very liberalism. And because this enemy hides like fish among the sea amongst good, peace loving Muslim populations, it's going to be a very difficult war to prosecute. And there are going to be more terrorist attacks, and it's going to be terrible. And you know what? We're going to man up and get through this because we're America, damn it. No, he's like, hey, mission accomplished, go shopping. We just don't do sacrifice anymore. And Trump obviously has not been able to do it. You know, but what's weird is we've got this patchwork response where you have the NBA just saying like, hey, we're just going to cancel the season, you know, and Disneyland shutting everything down. And then not before
having one last final magic moment where crowds are packed underneath the castle last night to see the fireworks.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, you have to check it out. It's just sick. It's sick.
It looked phantasmic.
Well, so, you know, it's a weird, weird thing to see. I mean, this is, I guess, what federalism looks like, right? Where you have some states being very responsible, some states being irresponsible. You have essentially no national leadership from the top. Everybody's just sort of doing what they want. I mean, in a weird way, this is what the Catholic Church looks like right now. I don't know. I mean, this is like a little inside Catholic baseball. But so every bishop in America is essentially their own king. Is how the Catholic Church hierarchy works. And so you have a situation where in the Washington, D.C. area, the Washington, D.C. bishop over the weekend said, hey, no more public masses, don't go to mass. The Richmond bishop said, no more masses, nobody go to mass. But the Arlington bishop, who's right in the middle of these two, was like, yep, everybody got to go to church or it's a mortal sin and then you need to go to confession. And there is no governing body. There's no way to you know, why should Northern Virginia be under different sort of health rulings than either Washington, D.C. or Richmond? There is no rhyme or reason to it, except that there's no single leading voice because the Pope has sort of abdicated responsibility on this in the same way that Trump has abdicated responsibility. on it.
Not the exact same way.
Well, similar.
Pope didn't have a press conference where the Cardinals all one by one came through and congratulated him for the rain and the sun and thanked him for his leadership.
Tim, I have a question for you.
Yeah. As a lapsed Catholic or as
another political professional? As a political professional, do you think it is possible that the Trump line from his Kraft conference where he said, "I don't take any responsibility at all," do you think it's possible that that could wind up in an ad come September or October?
I think it already is in an ad. I think I saw the folks at Acronym, I think, did an ad on it, a digital ad already. I thought David Frum had a very insightful observation about Trump, which is that his entire life, as the king of debt, he's been somebody that has been trying to decide what scheme, what scam could help him get through the next 24 hours, right? How can I change this news cycle? I have a bad news cycle about me. I guess I'll call the New York Post and pretend like I'm John Barron and talk about my sexual prowess to get them talking about this instead, right? How can I, stiff some vendors in order to buy me 24 hours to keep surviving? And, it worked for him. But that is how he has managed this, And so if you go through his timeline of comments, if you go through the just absurd, farcical Friday night, signing of the stock market spike and sending it to supporters and, sending out an all caps tweet, it's best stock market day in years, by saying that, by going from this is no big problem to I'm on top of everything to I take no responsibility for this because, there's nothing you can do about a virus like this. I'm doing the best anybody could possibly do. He's not capable of doing anything else besides saying whatever needs to be said to get him out of the next 24 hours. And so I think that, yes, that quote, the stock market comments, I think that there are going to be a number of things that you see in ads this fall. I think a lot of how effective that will be dependent on how well we come out of it.
In any other competent administration, I would have thought that this would be the moment to actually get a huge spike in your approval numbers by doing a rally around the flag thing. Would you think that too, Ben? But Trump, you wrote about this. It's the politics of owning. Like, Trump can't do a rally around the flag. He can only do the politics of owning.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's the politics of, this is the Democratic hoax. It's the politics of, if it's not making someone angry, if it's not making the right people angry, there's no room in the sort of Trumpian version of politics for, actually doing the things that government exists to do, like providing common goods, like, defense from threats, including pandemic diseases. And I'll say the best part, in my opinion, of that Rose Garden press conference was when, I think it was Michel Sindor of PBS, asked the president, "Well, you did dismantle the pandemic preparedness office within the National Security Council, which is part of the White House, part of the executive office of the president. Do you take responsibility for that?" And, the president says, "Well, no, I don't take any responsibility for that. They say it was me, but, it wasn't me. It's, this administration." And then he does the I don't even know what the word for it, like the absolute most juvenile and yet predictable thing possible. He says, maybe Dr. Fauci knows something about this. Dr. Fauci, who has been at the been the head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease since the 1980s, as far as I know, has not worked a day in the White House in his life. Trump sort of turns as if to beckon him over to the microphone, and Fauci just stands there shaking his head like, "No, I have no idea what you're talking about. I did not dissolve this office that I've never been connected to. How could I possibly have done that?" It was like, let me see if I have someone who's actually credible, the president seemed to be saying, someone who actually has some expertise and is actually doing a good job, if I can throw them under the bus, because, at least then I won't have to take responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So now can we pivot to Bernie and Biden, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Go for it. So I did not watch
no promises. I won't come back to make fun of the stonks market signature thing one more time, though. But yeah, we can pivot otherwise.
I did not watch this last night because I had better things to do with my life. Please tell me, how did it go, Jim?
At the very beginning, it felt like we were talking about this on the work Slack that Bernie was like trying to help Joe Biden out and go easy on him. And that quickly dissolved into more of a hot shooting war about 2/3 of the way through. But it was bizarre to watch. I think CNN did a good job, but it was like watching the Chicago White Sox and the Baltimore Orioles play in an empty stadium like they did in, I think, what was it, 2015? It's a very different dynamic to watch a debate that has no audience physically there. I think Joe Biden held his own. I didn't watch the entirety of it. Ben did, so he may have a different perspective than I do. But when it got spicier, you saw how well Joe Biden can do on a one-on-one debate stage. Because it's, you know, when it's a cafeteria food fight, you know, people will have different opinions as to who won and who lost. But when they're just, you know, Coke and Pepsi up there, I think Joe did a much better job than we've seen in recent debates.
Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Biden did. I was worried there for a bit because I remember it being much quicker than you do, Jim, of Bernie sort of stopping with the whole come together to fight coronavirus thing and start attacking Biden for everything, for a bankruptcy bill, for super PACs, which was, you know, I went and checked it this morning and was of, you know, was of dubious veracity. And you know, attacking him for his positions, you know, everyone under the sun. I think Amanda Carpenter has it right, writing in the Bulwark today, that this was sort of Bernie's last stand. He wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. He never had any interest in helping Biden. He never has interest in helping anyone apart from the revolution that he thinks he's heading. And what he wanted to do is, you know, I'm sure he knows that this might be the last time he's in a national debate stage. It might be the last time he's got such a high profile spot on national TV. And it seemed to me like he was saying, well, I've been in this half century project to try to move everyone, especially the Democratic Party, leftward. And I'm not going to help Joe Biden, the consummate moderate in this race, be elected. I'm gonna keep on doing what I've been doing for half a century, and I'm going to try to move the Overton window to the left. I'm not sure if he was effective, but it was the same Bernie we've always seen. He didn't change tack at all, and it was frankly kind of ugly. It made them both, I think, kind of look small. I don't think Biden did great, but I think Bernie really looked frustrated.
I just don't know that people are watching the nuances of this as closely as you or Ben to feel like you know, some of that, you know, some of that analysis is going to stick, you know, beyond this corona crisis. You know, for me, I like that debate and I see, you know, three things that are relevant. One, Biden goes in being accused of, you know, being, you know, basically sundowning and, you know, being a dementia laden senior citizen by Sanders and Trump. And at the debate and in his speech last week, he seemed absolutely competent and sharp. And I think that these guys set an absolutely low bar for him, particularly the Sanders folks, if they wanted to change the race. And Biden stepped over it easily, hopped over it. And so, two, related to that, that left Sanders with no opportunities to change the race last night. I mean, sure, there's an interesting discussion about, you know, whether he's more effective on this or that, if you're judging it on the points, but, you know, he didn't change the race at all. Biden made a big announcement about how he'd have a woman VP, whether or not you think that that's a savvy move that, you know, is sucked up the entire news discussion around it. Sanders didn't do anything. Biden's still set to be the nominee. So the only tactical issue I have, and I actually don't really know where I land on this, is, does having Sanders there as a foil help make Biden more centrist, or is Sanders pulling Biden to the left a little unnecessarily, you know, like you're seeing some of the, you know, MAGA talking heads, you know, jaw about this morning, particularly on some energy issues and immigration. I'm not quite sure where I land on that. I think that Biden could have been a little stronger at pivoting towards the center last night, but at the same time, you know, having Bernie up there talking to him about how insufficient his $1 million $1 trillion climate change plan is, you know, makes a pretty bold plan look rather centrist on the other hand. So I think that's the kind of dynamic to watch, you know, presuming Bernie stubbornly stays in.
Tim, how long do you think he stays?
It's tough. This coronavirus thing is changing the calculation kind of on both sides. You know, on the one hand, it makes his campaign look ridiculous. On the other hand, these elections are being delayed, so it gives him a justification to stay. I don't know. It's hard for me to get inside Bernie's head. It seems to me like he either hasn't come to the terms with the fact that this is a loss, or, you know, he feels like there's some other, you know, as Ben and Jim said, broader kind of justification for his staying in. And if either of those are true, what changes tomorrow that wasn't true 2 days ago?
Jim, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think Biden, even before his campaign resurrected itself, you know, in recent weeks, was already making a pivot to the left. Like, we all view Joe Biden the centrist. Joe Biden has been consistently going to the left for Joe Biden since the very beginning. He's perceived as a centrist because, you know, the political landscape has changed. And you know, the centrism camp, I guess the definition has changed a little bit. But I do think, to what Tim was saying, Bernie is trying to nudge him to go to the left on various issues, like fracking was one of the things they talked about last night. But, you know, you saw him abandon the Hyde Amendment and start going after gun manufacturers, not to bring it back to guns, but for end use liabilities. I think Bernie knows if he can land a couple good punches, the revolution will have scored minor victories if Joe Biden goes along with something. And keep in mind, like, Joe Biden abandoned the Hyde Amendment because a woman in a rope line convinced him to do so, pretty much. Bernie Sanders probably will have some success, and I think that's what he's trying to do.
So do you guys the most important news out of the debate was the woman VP thing, Cory Booker, yeah. Hardest hit. What do you think about that? Who immediately jumps to mind? I mean, I just assume that the person at the top of the short list has to be Klobo. Is that crazy?
No, I mean, I think a lot of people before Klobo raised her profile thought that the two high profile picks would be Kamala Harris or Stacey Abrams. I think both of those choices would be a mistake because the kind of moderate Democrat or never Trump Republican, I think, does not trust or like Kamala Harris. And they kind of view Stacey Abrams as this sore loser who, you know, is owed something for her electoral defeat.
You can't pick somebody because their qualification is having lost a gubernatorial race once. I mean, that's just crazy.
I forgot you, Ariel. She didn't lose it, right?
Yeah, right. I would say this: if Kamala Harris had not run for president, then she would be the only pick for VP.
Agree.
It was her presidential campaign really blew up the argument that she would help a ticket. Would you guys agree or disagree with that?
Totally agree with that. I mean, I don't think that she's blow up. I guess I don't totally agree. I think blow up is maybe a little overstated, but I agree with the first part, which is had she not run. I mean, I don't think they would have even had to vet anybody else. She would have been the clear choice. And her win does complicate it, because I just think it kind of revealed some of her weaknesses that were sort of shrouded by her ability to sort of be in the Senate and you know, pop out on issues of strength. I don't. Stacey Abrams would be a disaster of a pick. I just can't imagine he does it. With Biden, you need somebody that you can be confident can do the job immediately. A state senator is not the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, I think with Biden, I think always the games on this of trying to decide how somebody helps in a state. If they pick Tammy Baldwin, Wisconsin, well, you'll add some. I kind of don't buy that. I think that the answer is to pick somebody that Biden has a good rapport with, that can be trusted in an ideal world, that would be exciting to a slice of the electorate. But I think that's kind of a secondary goal. So my sleeper is Tammy Duckworth. I just think that having a veteran woman of color, would be a very challenging opponent for Donald Trump in a lot of ways. But I think any of the senators would be totally fine.
What about Tulsi?
Not Stacey Abrams. Those are the only two.
Maybe Tulsi will wind up on one of the tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Ben, do you have any dark horses for a VP pick?
No, I originally thought my dark horse candidate was going to be Buttigieg, but he eliminated that last night. He eliminated that possibility. If I could just get us a little bit.
I was hoping for a women and gays caveat. I'm just going to throw that out there. I was hoping that we could get kind of like a little caveat for the gays, but that's okay. I'm not going to take it personally.
Actually, one of the more surprising things I thought about this, obviously surprising that Biden made this commitment right there on TV. I was actually a little bit surprised that Bernie didn't follow up with a commitment of his own. It was just, you know, sort of strange. It's like, you know, you're not going to have a vice president, right? So, like, why not go ahead and say that? Especially when, you know, I view this in the larger context. He's really being trounced, as far as I'm aware, by Biden in state after state among African-Americans and suburban women. Right. Those are like two of the key demographics that are propelling Biden to these huge victories. So what does Sanders do in this debate? He compares a temporary worker program to slavery and doesn't make a commitment to put a woman on this ticket. It's like, who is giving this guy advice? You know,
that was bizarre.
He is who he is. You know, let me give you my dark horse pick,
please.
You guys ready?
Yep.
Condi.
Ooh, Condi.
Ooh, you like that? National unity ticket. And it signals to the Democrats that, hey, I'm not just anointing a successor. You guys can all figure this out 4 years from now. We just got to get past this. It's going to be a new America. We're going to be tough on foreign policy.
That's some great Bulwark fan fiction there, JBL, but I don't think that's real. Susan Rice, maybe. Mm. Susan Rice. I don't know. Mine is
Claire McCaskill.
Condi is only 65. She would add a real youth dimension to the ticket, you know?
Claire would be great. I mean, there is this like kind of dumb conventional wisdom that like you can't pick somebody that lost, right? I mean, Dick Cheney, you know, got picked. He wasn't a sitting anything. You know, I think that some of those Midwestern moderate Senate Democrats like Claire, like Heidi Heitkamp. You know, he should consider those folks. I mean, I think those are reassuring picks.
And Claire's a street fighter too.
She is.
You know, and I did not like Claire McCaskill. I used to live in Missouri. I did not vote for her. Worked on the same floor as her in the Hart office building. But when I saw what Missouri brought in Josh Hawley, I was like, I kind of miss Claire McCaskill.
All right, guys, we're starting to run long here. We should sign off. Does anybody have anything else they want to do real quick before we, you know, slap the car back together and try to hope that Charlie doesn't notice we took it out for a spin?
Wash your hands.
Tim?
I'm happy to challenge anybody in an NBA 2K 2020 battle. If there are any listeners that want to do that, that's how I'm spending my self-quarantine.
You know what? Let me ruin your life.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the company Arcade 1-Up?
Not really.
So what they make is 3/4 scale arcade cabinets. So like a semi-mini version of your old school arcade cabinet. And they have a small selection of absolutely true-to-life arcade games in a cabinet with the joysticks and the buttons and everything. Oof. One of which, Tim, is NBA Jam.
The original?
Uh-huh.
Oh, man, so I'm getting tingly over here. What's the cost on that?
$299. You could have this thing delivered to your house basically the day after tomorrow. You set it up in like 45 minutes, and then you just pop a stool there, and it's like you're 12 years old all over again. Scotty Skiles and all of the NBA greats of your youth. Jamal Mashburn. I mean, come on.
You can't see is it a Gary Payton, Sean Kemp duo, you know, the oops. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Marv Albert. Okay, I'm getting excited. Okay, send me the link.
He's on fire. Do you remember NBA Jam? How great that was.
Oh, my gosh. It was so good. I'm going to have to connect you with my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law actually makes these.
No.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that more offline.
Offline, because I am close to buying the Marvel superheroes version of this, because this thing could go on for God knows how long. We're on hour 77 or 78 over here in our quarantine, and at some point I may decide that I have to take my chances with the virus because my children will kill me first.
Shave up. That's not funny. I'm okay. Laughing, but it's not funny.
I know it's not. It's too soon. Too soon. All right, guys. Jim, Ben, Tim, thanks for coming in to do this. Charlie, thanks for letting us borrow the keys to the car. Charlie Sykes will be back to host the Bulwark podcast tomorrow, and he will do this all over again.